Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Well, today we're lucky to have in the studio with us Farai Chidea, who joins us. Hasn't seen her in a long time. Farai, welcome to the studio. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. I am delighted.
Really good to see you.
Yeah, it's great to see you.
Back in Baltimore, grew up here, Western High School. Of course, we all remember her when she was the host of News and Notes, which was one of NPR's great programs. She's now senior writer for 538. She's distinguished writer in residence at the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at NYU, New York University. And this new book, The Episodic Career, which is really, really fascinating. I wasn't sure what to expect, but now I do know what to expect since I finished it. Good to have you.
Thanks so much.
Folks, join us, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. I almost don't know where to begin. The book is one place to begin since we're talking about the book. But
yeah, we can talk politics. We can talk Baltimore. We can talk anything.
There's so much to talk about.
Absolutely.
And actually, politics, I thought a lot about politics as I was reading the book because you can't get very far away from it. It's interesting. People can look at this book and say, oh, you're giving me a self-help book about how to find a job. That's an easy way to kind of underline this book.
Yep.
They might put that on the shelf somewhere in a bookstore, put that out there as this. But that's not what it is, because you're really talking about the nature of existence in America, how difficult it is in this country, not blaming it all on the individual, but trying to find this balance and help people figure out, how do I survive in the midst of this madness that we're faced with?
Exactly. I mean, you know, there was a write-up in The Guardian, this UK paper.
I read that write-up.
Yeah, yeah, that basically, I think, hit the nail on the head in terms of what this book is about. It's like, well, so there's so much shaming and blaming of not just poor and working class people in America, but people who are who may seem more comfortable but are living paycheck to paycheck, which is most Americans. And this book I decided to write because as a journalist for 25 years, I've been diagnosing problems. This book diagnoses problems, but it also offers some personal solutions. It's basically like, until our government gets it together, here's some ways to roll with the punches. And there's some heavy punches coming at people around jobs. There's the decline in defined benefits programs, meaning pensions, so that people are not saving enough for retirement. There's the instability in the job market, where jobs are lasting only 4.5 years at a time on average, which means a lot of people are effectively switching jobs every couple years, you know, once you take into account
which
other
many
people.
Many of us have done.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just saw so much pain in America and pain about people who feel like life is passing them by. And I think that both on the progressive side, the rise of Sanders, and on the nativist side, the rise of Trump, come out of that pain. And so we have to acknowledge the pain, but move in a positive direction and not, you know, stab each other in the back.
In a way, it's when I was looking at this book, it made me think about, you're trying to talk about how we might survive in the midst of this, just to get through and move ahead.
Yes.
And understanding what it is, but not giving up on the notion that we have to change society.
Oh, no. The only way to make things better in the long run is if we, you know, reinvest in labor unions, if we reinvest in some kind of workable pension plans or things that basically don't leave it up to the stock market to plan for people's futures. If we start dealing with issues like educational debt, where, you know, I meet undergrads who have taken on $80,000 to $150,000 in debt. And, you know, so there's all these structural issues that I end up talking about in the book. Also things about native-born Americans and immigrants being pitted against each other in low-wage jobs. I talk about that happening in New Orleans.
That's a really interesting interview you did with that man in New Orleans.
So, I mean, so I get into some heavy stuff, but the book is very practical because I feel like I learned some things in my own life and also through my reporting about how to roll with the punches in this economy. And I do believe that if people feel a little more secure, we will be less likely to tear ourselves apart. And if we're less likely to tear ourselves apart, we might actually collaborate and get those bigger solutions moving.
One approach you took in this book I found interesting, I just want to throw out there first, just for a minute, is that in one part of the book, you do mention race. You talk about race in terms of race and gender bias that you've experienced as a black woman in the workplace. But for the most part, when you deal with race, it's because of the people you interview who happen to be African-American or Asian-American or who they are and what their life experience has been, using that narrative as opposed to kind of just talking about racism as kind of a battering ram through the book.
Right. Yeah, I wanted people to – because a lot of people who – a lot of people shut down when they hear anything about race because they think that if they're, for example, not a person of color, they're being accused of a crime of racism, no matter who they are. So I have, for example, this woman, Jenny Yee, in the book, who's 20 at the time. She was 22, child of Cantonese speaking immigrants. And she does a lot of housing activism in New York for these Cantonese. Most of the Chinese immigrants in New York speak Cantonese, and a lot of them now are — Chinatown is a hot real estate neighborhood, and they're being illegally evicted. And so she works with groups that try to help prevent these illegal evictions of Chinese immigrants from Chinatown, which is now becoming Soho South or whatever.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, right. That's what happens. Right. You know, right. Neighborhoods just get pushed. And so, and she's also someone who's a computer programmer and works as a data journalist. And so by reading her story, you understand how her passion for understanding information is meshed with this passion for helping her community, which is where she grew up. And likewise, when I talked to Betty Reed Soskin, who was 92 when I spoke to her and who's a friend of mine, she's 94 now, works full-time.
Good for her. Yes.
Works full-time as an educational National Parks Ranger. But when
That was so interesting.
Oh, she's great. Yeah. And so she started out as a clerk in a segregated union hall in the 1920s. And then during the growth of the war industry, she found so much racism.
And her husband both.
Yeah, she and her husband in the U.S. military and in, you know, kind of the administrative end of the U.S. government, that they said, we'll never work for a white person again. And they started their own business selling, quote, race records. And the business is still around today, Reed's Records in Oakland, California. But then she went back and actually ended up working for the government because she was able to find a way to do that kind of historical narrative within, you know, a different structure. So it's all about understanding. When I introduce themes of race and class, which I do throughout the book, it's about understanding how different people have different challenges. And then I talked to Christine. I don't mention her name, but she's white and she lives in Seattle. She was a street prostitute for 20 years and drug addicted and detoxed herself. And so her narrative has a lot to do with, you know, what we're seeing now about heroin addiction, but also recovery. And she went from being a street prostitute to a cleaning lady and then became a welder. And so race and class come out throughout this book.
So that's one of the reasons I love this. I really wasn't sure what to expect, but when I read about it, given that you've gone through your transitions in this business.
Many, and still will.
And still will, and even at my stage, we're facing transitions in this business again. And so I thought about this episodic career thing and how deep it is. I mean, because you acknowledge workers being between a rock and a hard place. But let me jump to the early part of the book here, where you get into your life matrix. That I found that really fascinating. I mean, I usually shy away from these kind of things.
Yeah.
Don't put me in this damn box. I'm not just one thing, right?
Yeah.
but having said that, you asked these four questions, and I obviously took this test, and I ended up as a writ.
That's the same as me. I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised.
So, but let's talk about this and where this came about. But it really is interesting. I mean, because you have these are fascinating stories that you talked about. Some of them we'll get to in a minute. But talk about what this means, the work-life matrix.
Yeah.
Four core questions.
Yeah.
How they came about.
Yeah. So basically, the work-life matrix is a self-diagnostic tool that I incorporated into the book. So just to back up a little bit, I had been reporting on work for quite a while. I saw certain tendencies in certain people. And then I said, how can I quantify this? Because I was interested in creating something, again, that would be helpful to people. So one question asks, are you a risk taker? Or are you more cautious in your career? One asked, do you like to do high social impact work? or do you work for money, which is not a bad thing. You know, you could volunteer right. or whatever, but, you know, your job just pays the bills. Are you an innovator or are you someone who likes to finish projects? Or finally, you know, do you like to make decisions alone or in a team? And so our type, the RHIT, the RIT, is the promoter, which means you promote values that you believe in, whether, you know, some kind of social justice or agenda that is bigger than yourself. It's not just about self-promotion. And so a lot of people who do community organizing or people, journalists, there's a lot of people who end up in the promoter category who are passionate about high social impact work. And it can be draining. And, you know, I try to talk. Yeah. The reason that I put, you know, people who do high social impact work are actually, when I ran all these surveys, I did a bunch of survey research, are less satisfied than people who work just for money. And at first I was confused by that, but then it's like, well, if you're trying to earn, whether it's 25 grand a year, 50 grand, or, you know, 300 grand a year, you know when you hit your goal. But if your goal is to make society better, you're probably never going to be done.
Right.
And that's and once you understand things like that, you can also have a little more compassion for yourself. Because every one of these 16 archetypes that comes out of these four questions has different skills and different aptitudes and different weaknesses. And I know for me, one of my weaknesses is frustration. I get frustrated very easily, less so over time as I've gotten older, but I get frustrated when I see obvious injustice in the workplace, obvious injustice in society, whatever. And I'm like, why can't I make this better? And so one of the kind of inflection points for people who do high social impact work is to really just say, okay, you keep pushing that rock up the hill, but it's not going to be easy. And you may never reach the top of, you may never reach the mountaintop, so to speak.
So, and these categories, I mean, I think that they're, I mean, they really get explained when you talk about the different people inside of these 16 different types you can be. But talk a bit about that. I mean, because again, you know, people do kind of lurch backwards when you talk about what type am I? Am I the right hand man or woman? Am I the you have so many types in here.
Yeah, the co-creator in chief.
The co-creator in chief.
The chief of staff. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. You know, and so what I did was I literally interviewed hundreds of people for this book. Not everyone made it inside the book, but what I do is for each archetype, I come up with one story of someone who tested into that archetype. And so one of the people whose stories I really like, which is much more kind of in some ways conventional, but not really, is this guy, Aaron Keough, and he is an RPES, which means that, you know, he does not necessarily care about high social impact. He likes, you know, executing things, getting things done, but he's willing to take risks. And so Aaron is this guy who falls into the Mr. or Ms. Get It Done category, where he was an armored guard carrying cash, strapped with a gun, you know, all that stuff. Figured out that was a dead-end job. He was unemployed when his wife was pregnant with their third child, and he ended up, you know, burning the candle at both ends, going to school and working, relocated the family to find more opportunity and more help, and now is a middle manager. And that's the kind of story where it says so much about the economy. It's like you can't necessarily wait for somebody else to save your bacon. You know, he's a guy who had a lot of family obligations. He didn't have a lot of what you might consider white-collar skills when he started out working as an armored security guard, but he had the perseverance to say, I will figure this out on behalf of myself and my family. And you know, there's stories, I mean, no matter whether you're someone who really views work as an adventure or someone who views it as a series of Sisyphean trials or whatever, there's going to be someone in the book you can relate to. So I also urge people, no matter where you end up on this little scale that I've created, to go and look at all the stories.
Yeah, because there's a little bit, I mean, you can be on the scale, but there's so much of you in all these other characters.
Yeah.
In terms of the lives you led. And one of the important things about this is that at first I was worried, but then I was sort of reading more and more that it's not just about the person who is upper middle class or is college educated. It's stories from every kind of class and racial background.
Yeah,
society,
there's a guy in New Orleans who, you know, he was formerly imprisoned and also using drugs and became a labor organizer in New Orleans and works with a group.
Alfred Marshall?
Yeah, Alfred Marshall. And he works with a group that has two different divisions, one for migrant workers who are Latino who worked in construction in New Orleans, and one for native black New Orleanians, both low income. And basically what they do is they run two separate divisions, but then they bring them together and say, don't undercut each other. Don't, you know, underbid each other for these jobs. The only way that you're going to get ahead is by collaborating. And I think that that's a really important lesson, because a lot of times when we talk about social justice, there's this question of, you know, insider space and common space. Like, so why do all the black people need a black people meeting? You know, it's like, well, sometimes the black people just need a black people meeting. But then the black people also need to talk to other people. And a lot of times, you know, it's important to have spaces where people feel safe and where they can discuss issues on their own term, but then say it's not enough to just feel safe with your own people. You have to create these bridges. And I think that Alfred's story gets to that on so many levels. He's also another one of the people I profiled who's dealt with addiction. He's another one of the people who has dealt with incarceration, but he's also one of those people who's really a powerful...
Son was murdered?
Yeah, his son was murdered, basically for being a peacemaker. And I looked this up. I didn't just take his word for it. I looked up the police accounts and
things
like that.
You're a journalist. You went behind. Is this true?
Yeah,
right?
His son was murdered basically in retaliation for mixing with different sets, you know, different gangs in New Orleans and trying to bring people together. And it was really senseless. And so he's also a man who's had to learn to forgive. And now his son threw an annual party to try to bring people together. And now they do it as a memorial to him, to
Siddiqui.
His son. Siddiqui.
He created a drink called the Siddiqui drink they give out for free.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. You read this back and forth. Yeah. Yeah.
So, folks, do join us at 410-319-8888. Want to hear your thoughts on this. 410-319-8888. Because all of us are going through these turmoils. We're all facing things with jobs that do not have retirement, jobs that are not paying as much as they should, jobs that are really shaky. We don't know whether they're going to be there, whether they will be employed. And the world we have, the Mark Steiner Show and the Center for Emerging Media, we're always on the edge of, are we going to lose our funding, going to have the money to keep going, not keep going, produce what we produce. And those things are real. And so people are all in this thing like that. And I was wondering, just a digression, I was thinking about how you describe people's lives in this book and what they do to survive and get ahead. And I want to get to some of the specifics in that you do towards the end of the book. But when you look at this political world we're in now, and you mentioned earlier, and you see this rise of Donald Trump, and you know that race and racism are deeply embedded in why Trump is moving out ahead, and you look at Bernie Sanders' race and people being disgruntled with whether it's Clinton or the establishment Republicans.
Yeah.
Even if they're voting for them, they're disgruntled with them for the most part,
yes.
Right? So I'm curious how you see that bridge being built, if that bridge can be built.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's because it's a really tough thing to do. It's a quick little anecdote. I remember three different instances in my life where we organized in poor white communities and built these bridges. Once in Chicago between the Young Patriots and the Panthers and people in the late 60s. Here in Baltimore with a thing called the Tenants Union Group that brought poor black and poor white people together when South Baltimore was still poor, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the Mississippi-Alabama border between the woodcutters, black and white, who hated each other, had to work together, and their wives forced them to struggle for the union together.
Wow.
Right? So those things can happen, but they're few and far between. And since race is dividing it, but class and the economy are fueling it, we're at a very kind of volatile moment.
Yeah, we are. And, you know, there's so many stories. There's a movie that's going to come out I think early next year called The Free State of Jones.
Oh yes, Mississippi during the Civil War.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's about a white soldier who deserts from the Confederate Army and ends up hiding out in the swamps with
a bunch of talk about it?
Yeah. Well, this is a feature.
Oh, really?
Starring Matthew McConaughey. And
very cool.
But there's been other things done about it. But, you know, but even during, you know, the Civil War, there were poor whites who recognized that they were no more empowered than the escaped enslaved people and who joined forces together and formed communities and built families together. And so the thing is, it's like when I look at the people who are following Donald Trump, first of all, I'm familiar with them because I have interviewed the Klan face to face. I've gone to Tea Party rallies. I've seen the spectrum of people who are nativist from the more violent to the nonviolent, but people who really believe, you know, among the nonviolent people, people who believe they're right. And of course, not every Trump person is, you know, is as nativist as some of them. But I understand that there have been so many centuries of programming in America that say your problem is the person next down the ladder. So that your white privilege, if you're poor, means that the only person that you can blame is a non-white person who is of your income. But it's all, I mean, it's just a scam, basically. I mean, it's like if you took all of the black people and all of the immigrants out of America, poor, there'd still be poor white people, you know?
Right.
And
right.
So this idea that you are going to embrace this this billionaire who has gone into bankruptcy several times, he says, I didn't go into bankruptcy, my companies did. It's like, what the heck does that even mean? So basically what you're saying is that you keep all the money and you throw the trash to everyone else.
And the people, and fire all the people who are stuck working for you.
Right, and Trump University, so-called Trump University, which was a kind of real estate Ponzi scheme, has three pending class action lawsuits. But I really compare Donald Trump to the Mega Millions. You know, I will occasionally buy a Mega Millions ticket, you know, when it's a big pot, but I don't expect to win. But people look at him as some kind of lottery ticket to this this wonderful future where everyone has a gold-plated toilet. And as much as I'm mocking it on one level, I also understand that. When you are really just back against the wall, you want some kind of Hail Mary pass that's going to make your whole life better. But if we don't realize that there are that, you know, poor white Americans, and not just poor, but working class and middle class white Americans, have as much of a stake in building strong public schools, in having, you know, less educational debt at the university level, in having better retirement protections. If we don't realize this, we're not going to get anywhere as a country. And so my book, you know, if I can self-diagnose to the extent. My book has many weaknesses, like all books, but I think it's very useful. But in the episodic career, I would like to do a whole separate section on policy, like what do we really need to do to rebuild America, to make America great, to use a well-worn phrase. But
who says that?
Yeah, I don't know. This guy with orange hair, but you know, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that I understand why people would embrace Donald Trump, because a lot of people who have their backs against the wall want someone to, you know, take the blame. And just briefly, I interviewed a Klanswoman. It was in Frederick, Maryland, right after a blizzard in a park and ride lot. They had closed the school, so it was me, one of my white Southern friends who warned me that we were race mixing. So him going with me, he was happy to go with me, but he probably couldn't protect me. And three Klans people meeting for me to report on a story. And this woman kept talking about how she wanted to move to an all-white area and how they had a daughter and they wanted to protect her. And all I could think was, you don't have a race problem, you have a poverty problem. There's plenty of all-white neighborhoods in America, but you're poor. And you can't live in the one you want to live in. And that disconnect. It's like, if you want to live just with white people, there's so many places you could go. But you just don't have any money.
Right, right.
And so you're blaming your black neighbors because you can't live in a white neighborhood. That's not, to me, I could see it so clearly. But to her, it was, the problem was that you had to have a legal segregation. You know, that you had to go back to an apartheid style, you know, white homeland, black homeland thing. And it's like, well, you'll still be on the poor side of the white homeland and the rich white people still won't want to hang out with you.
It's a really hard one to overcome. I mean, because one of the things to think about this thing about your book and thinking about that is that the only way that changes, this book is about people who struggle and I'm getting specific to talk about how they struggle and the things they do to survive and which can be lessons for all of us. But in that struggle, unless people struggle together around an issue,
yep,
those folks around Trump will remain who they are.
Absolutely.
And remain part of a force that is a threat to anybody who's not white in America and to other people in America as well. I mean, there are also,
I would say, black and Mexican American Trump supporters, so we should just acknowledge that too.
Right, they're there. So this is a very volatile and strange time, and in some ways it feeds into this because your book is about the volatility of the moment we live in. And even though many people you write about are people who take on the system in overt, covert ways and want to fight for change, it's about how they maneuver to survive within it.
Yes.
Because that's part of it. I was thinking that's exactly right.
Yeah, right? The book is a survival guide to jobs because I see so many people suffering, like I said. And, you know, I'm not a policymaker. I can analyze policy. But right now, people need right now solutions. And that's what I wanted to do with this book.
Yeah, because it's like approaching this in terms of the our ability to kind of make it through this, and as I tell people all the time, and that's why I think this book really hit me, is that you – I'm jumbling my words here. Let me get this – slow this down. Is that when you struggle against the system and try to change the society we're living in, you also have to take care of yourself.
Yes.
You have to be able to pay your bills. You have to take care of your children. You have to be able to look for your future and plan about what's going to happen to you when you get older. You have to think about these things because the system right now is not going to take care of you.
Yep.
And you either collectively, familially, individually have to do that for yourself. And this is part of wrestling with how do we do that while we're trying to make things different.
Yeah. And I have a whole section at the beginning of the book about the health risks both of work and unemployment. And I tell an anecdote, which is true, about being at Artscape last summer
right. And
running into a friend who both of us know. I won't mention his name on air, but I'll tell you later. And he said that one of his fraternity brothers had killed himself and his two sons. And it was because he had had long-term unemployment and he'd gotten this temp job. He thought he was back on track. And then when he lost his temp job, he decided he didn't want to live in this world, but he also didn't want his sons to grow up. And so one of the things that also happens is that the crushing issues of poverty and insecurity can make us irrational. We begin to see the whole world as a place that we can't survive in. And I think about part of my family are free, ancestrally are free black farmers who lived in Virginia, Westmoreland County, before the end of slavery. And they owned land and they farmed. And somehow during an era where one of my ancestors was almost snatched by the paddy rollers and in 12 Years a Slave style, somehow they managed to figure out that they needed to survive. And that's why I exist. So we need to also take care of ourselves mentally and physically and financially because the story's not written yet. They didn't even know whether slavery would end, but they kept on going. And we have to keep on going now. It's not easy, but we have to keep on going.
So I'm going to get into keep on going. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I really want to kind of wrestle with all the precariousness we live in and the different ways people are wrestling with how they survived in this book and wrestle with questions of emotional resilience, self-knowledge, and the other things we talk about here that we all have to wrestle with to make it. Join us here at 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're here with Farai Jadeh. Joins us back in the studio here. We'll remind you on the way to back to the conversation with Farai that you can join us tonight. And she'll be speaking tonight at the Enoch Pratt Library at their Center for the Blind and for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Start at 6:30. And I'll be there with Farai. We'll be talking about this book. We're talking about now the episodic career, how to thrive at work in the age of disruption. And it's going to be a great conversation. Get there early. That place always fills up. And get your seat in line and join us here for that. But join us now at 410-319-8888 for this conversation about her book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. And just going into the heart of what you talk about here. And I think that there's this whole piece in here about the notion of emotional resilience, the idea that where we are and what we have to find our way through this.
Yes.
And everybody, no matter where they're classified in this matrix, has to find this emotional resilience.
Exactly.
We all have to find it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I also want to say to anyone who wants to call in, I've done a lot of work on the impact of race, the impact of gender, the impact of age discrimination, how to find a job. If you have super practical questions, we've been talking big picture, but I also have some very super practical advice. But to circle back to resilience, what I found both in my own personal life, you know, like when News and Notes ended and I was sort of at a loss with what to do with my life, but also, of course, in the stories of people who I interviewed, is that the ability to take, you know, to take a punch in the gut, whether it's being laid off or being discriminated against on the job or simply, you know, we all reach these points where we have these little existential crises, like, what am I doing?
Right, right.
Like, why am I spending 8 to 10 hours a day in this workplace, wasting my life and getting closer to the finish point without, you know, any real meaning there? But people who say, I am going to press on, and even if I don't have the answer today, I will figure out a way, are people who end up doing well. So I talk about the story of a woman named Carmen Rita Wong, who later went on to become a personal finance expert, and for a while she had a show on CNBC. But her father was in the computer industry, became unemployed, but he had that attitude, which some people have, which is like, I'm not going to take a job that's beneath me. So for years, he was unemployed because he couldn't get a job, quote, at the level that he deserved. Meanwhile, she and her mother were working in fast food, and she's like, we would come home stinking from, you know, fry grease because somebody needed to feed the family, and she had a bunch of younger siblings, too. And, you know, she's gone on to live a pretty glamorous life in a lot of ways, but it's because she knew, push comes to shove, she could do anything that she had to make ends meet. And some of us will be asked to do more than others in terms of, you know, shifting gears. But one of the things I say, one of the things that has happened with this economy since the Great Recession is that there's more long-term unemployment. And so in a country where most people are living paycheck to paycheck and the average duration of unemployment is half a year, you can see how pretty quickly that adds up to disaster. You know, mm-hmm. people losing their homes, people draining their retirement accounts, et cetera, et cetera. And so I am a big proponent of the good enough job, meaning I had a good job and now I would like another good job. But for the moment, I'm going to take a good enough job because there's also something that economists call hysteresis, which is that if you are long-term unemployed, people believe you are unemployable. So sometimes it's better to take a job mm-hmm. that is not as great as the one you had before and work your way back up. And I also get into the story of a woman named Elaine Chen, who's had 14 jobs in 25 years. And she's taken huge pay cuts at times. But it's just like, stay in the game, have that resilience, keep moving, because you cannot always count on having the same level of opportunity, just as you can't. You know, the stock market doesn't stay the same. The government doesn't stay the same. What opportunities you have aren't going to stay the same. But you can find that reserve of strength that says, I'm not my job. First of all, that's an important thing. In America, a lot of people are judged by what job they have.
The first question we ask, as you write about in the book, Americans always says, so, as soon as you meet them, so what do you do?
Exactly.
Where do you work?
Exactly.
Right.
You know, so that can be very depressing. Like if you, right. you know, I have a friend who's a retired journalist who, you know, he wasn't even pushed out of a job. He retired, but he said, you know, I don't have anything to talk about at cocktail parties anymore. You know, it's like not the worst problem. At least he's got a, you know, a home and a wife and a daughter. But he feels like he has lost value in society. And so whether it's through unemployment or retirement or underemployment, we feel linked to this identity. But we also have to realize we have innate worth. We have value simply because we have value. And paradoxically, if you realize that your value is not just about your job, you're more likely to have a job because you're more likely to have that resilience and say, I'm a good person when I'm employed and I'm a good person when I'm unemployed. And you have that fire and that spirit that allows you to keep going.
Folks, join us, 410-319-8888. I saw some things light up, but we'll get you in here. Call 410-319-8888. We'd love to hear your experiences in this world of work and switching work and what you experience on the job and what you've experienced in terms of how you try to move ahead when times are hard and what just personally what you're expecting and what you've been living through. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can, of course, tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. I want to get your calls coming in now and hear your thoughts on all this and where you and what your stories are that could be part of this book as well. And, you know, I was thinking you write a lot about you interview this guy, Goolsbee.
Yeah, Austin Goolsbee.
Austin Goolsbee. Fascinating thinker. And he writes his one piece here about the indicator of the middle class's future in the United States is schooling. The average debt is $24,000. Many people are much greater than that. And this becomes a real problem. Some of the people who interviewed around this are people who have been stuck in debt.
Yep.
Because of this. And was it Garvin Gittins you talk about, who was the poster child for this, who spent all this money on a private university for a junior college or community college and couldn't find a job. It was worthless. The school was worthless.
Yeah.
So this is a real trick back for people in America now.
Yeah.
Which one of the reasons Bernie Sanders, for some people, is catching on.
Yeah, absolutely. Sanders has done a great job about talking about educational debt. And I really do. I think that there is a mercenary attitude among schools that are leaving students holding the bag with extreme educational debt.
Yeah.
But also there has to be a readjustment in our philosophy. You know, it's like, again, it gets back to this whole idea of policy. There should be policies that prevent some of this from happening. But until then, you have to be really smart about getting a higher education. You know, I have a friend who, she and her husband both have, decent paying municipal jobs, not great, and their daughter is really smart, but they're like, yeah, the plan is for her to do 2 years of community college and then finish off at a 4-year school, because they know that, you know, the prestige of 4 years at a 4-year college is not measured by the relief of not having massive educational debt. And you also have to remember President Obama switched colleges, too. So it's not, you don't have to be someone who is, you don't have to look at community college as a fallback. You know, people have to get practical.
That's so important to say, because I had a conversation with a couple of young people in the last few weeks about that. One guy was in our office who was cleaning the lavatories in the office where we have the Center for Emerging Media. And he's in community college to get his AA as a machinist.
Mm-hmm.
While he's working for the Navy in some kind of graphic design and cleaning bathrooms on the side, right?
Wow!
So, and young man who grew up on the West Side, but he knows he says, "I like to write poetry, I like to read books, but I'm gonna become a machinist and make a living."
Yeah,
that's a smart way to think.
It is,
right?
Yeah.
So a lot of people are calling in. A lot of people calling to get the name of the book, but calling in now to talk as well. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Myra. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello.
Good morning, Myra.
Hi, Myra.
Good morning. I just want to say that it really feels like that you're talking about my life. Like, I'm 32 years old. I'm at the point where I really don't want to go to school, because I know that the type of job that I want to do, I can show and prove. Like, if jobs had more on-the-job training, where they let you come in, you train with them, they teach you what to do, and then let you execute, a lot more people would be employed, because a lot of people are looking at these jobs like, okay, you want all these credentials, but then I see what you're asking me to do, and that piece of paper on the wall is not necessary to do that job. So then when you get into these jobs and you're working for these big corporations, like it's happened to me, you're working for these big corporations and you're a go-getter. You got initiative, so you want to solve the problems immediately. You don't want to take 6 months to do it by this way, because that's the company policy, and they want to use your ideas and drain your ideas, but they don't want to use you in the position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's like, I was working in a lab. I lost my job because they tried to say it was the attendance policy, but it wasn't the attendance policy. I lost my job because you guys were tired of hearing my mouth. Because it's like, you can't take advantage of people. We don't work on the plantation. The fact that you want mandatory overtime on Saturday, there's some people out here that have been planning something for the last 6 months. but it's going to they're going to get that appearance, and it's going to sit on your record for a year because you couldn't make that hours, or they're telling you you're not good enough to do this, but you know, in the end of the day, your work is good enough. I trained a supervisor and a team leader, two people in front of me,
right.
And I ran a lab completely by myself for a year, but because I was only there 2 years versus their 18 and their 25, you feel me? They had the loyalty to the company where they, it's like, we're
right.
already in here.
So, and Myra, I think your story is emblematic of a lot of stuff that's in this book as well.
Yeah. I mean, Myra, you know, there's a bunch of different things you bring up. One is, you know, like the mandatory overtime. I have a bunch of different people in the book who talk about working
right.
for companies that, especially in the past few years, demand more for no pay. You know, they say you have to work more hours and everyone's too afraid to leave. Another thing is communication skills, where it sounds like you were vocal about some of the things that you saw and people didn't like that. And I know for me, you know, I sometimes have to dial it back because I, you know, I'm serious. Like I speak my mind in the workplace, but that's not always valued. And it and sometimes it, you have to figure out strategically, you know, that saying it's easier to catch flies with honey than vinegar. Sometimes There's a word in corporate America or a phrase, managing down and managing up. Managing down meaning working with people your level and junior. Managing up meaning working with people who are senior to you. And for a long time, I thought managing up basically meant kissing ASS. And but I have learned that if you don't manage up, then a lot of times it makes your life harder. So one thing to think about is how can you retain your sense of dignity while still recognizing that managing up is really important. It's a skill, and I'm not good at it, but I've had to learn to be better at it.
And you're right about that when you talk about yourself and you took on four other women the question of gender discrimination in the workplace, talking to a CEO that didn't do you any favors in that job
exactly.
Because you did that.
Yeah.
But you did it.
Yeah, I did it. It was a case where, you know, a group of women had a different idea about how to execute a group something than a group of men at a company I was working for. And the women turned out to have the better idea, but they were shut out of the meeting. And so I just went to the CEO and said, you can't shut these people out because they have the most expertise. But the CEO was angry at me. And I don't mean just annoyed. I mean, he was angry at me. Later on, I think he came to respect me, but it hurt me for a while. It really did hurt me. And, you know, sometimes you just have to take the hit, but sometimes you also have to learn to, you know, bite your tongue and nod your head. But then on top of it, the last thing I would say, Myra, is the question of credentials. Unfortunately, it's more and more common for people to require credentials for jobs that don't need them, which can mean that even though it makes no sense, you have to go and get the cheapest degree that you can find, and it will help you. I mean, basically, there's something like 80% of jobs that don't require a college degree still ask for one.
Right.
You know, and that is another messed up version of what we're doing in the workplace, but it's a reality, and how you choose to deal with it is up to you. But that's how a lot of companies think.
And as you write, jobs are not training people. You have to train yourself.
You
have to figure
out. You have
to
train yourself.
Because we're just stuck there. It doesn't mean we can't fight for that to exist, but it mm-hmm. doesn't exist. 410-319-8888. Arami, you're on the air. Welcome.
Okay. Hi, Mark. And hello,
Jordan. Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. My problem is exactly what she's saying as well. I believe I suffer from ageism and racism. I have been unemployed, doing just a little job since 2009. So at that point, I was a nurse tech going to school to become an RN. And in between, I lost my job because when final exams come, I was always in trouble for getting there late or for different reasons. Now, after I finished, I graduated from CCDC, obtained my associate, and then I was still looking for a job. So I have hundreds of interviews since, and no job at all.
Mm-hmm.
So what I noticed is like, that's why sometimes I have a term for these people. I call them gatekeepers. Everybody interviewed me was a young white woman or a young white man. And it's always no. So people say, go to USA job. I have a profile there, no result. Go to Maryland State. I have a profile, no result. And I'm like 2 semesters away from my bachelor degree at UMBC. So even at UMBC, I apply for a job and no job at all. And mind you, so I have what I have at this point, an associate degree, a bachelor degree, a semester away, and speak 4 languages. And I can't even find any job. I mean, the minimum job I cannot even find. So I'm very interested by what she's saying. I may be able to get the book. What does she propose to me? What should I do at this point? You know, I'm just locked out of job, economic
gotcha.
Opportunities, and everything.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm sorry that you've had to deal with this, because it sounds like you have been doing everything to improve your standing in the workforce. But I would also say that, and this may be hard to listen to, it may or may not also help, but I would circle back with some of the people who you interviewed with and say, you know, I didn't receive a call back from you. I'm close to my bachelor's degree. First of all, I wanted to update you on my skills. And secondly, I'd like to know what I can do to be a more competitive candidate, which is a nice way of saying, why didn't you hire me? And you can ask them. They may not respond, but you could say, I'd just like to know how to be a more competitive candidate once I have my bachelor's. And first of all, that's not putting any blame on them. So they're not going to feel attacked. They may not respond, but you're also letting them know that you updated your skills. So go back to all those places, whether or not they have a position open. Because another one of the weird things about the job market today is a lot of times once people post jobs, they are effectively filled. Even if they do interviews,
right.
They have an inside candidate that they want to hire, and they just do a few interviews just to, you know, kind of make it seem like an open process. So sometimes you have to go to people before they're hiring, and you go, you know, again, the honey and vinegar thing, go back and say, you know, I'm so excited. I'm close to getting my bachelor's degree. Keep it very positive, very upbeat. And I also think that if you are not on the platform LinkedIn, you should join that.
That really does help.
Yeah. I mean, it helps you understand the job market. I'm not selling any product
right.
for anyone. But
right,
what LinkedIn does is that if you learn how to use the platform, you can see how other people, they have all these online tutorials that tell you how to format your profile. And then networking today is key. I talk in the book about weak ties. There's this
this
theory about employment that the people who are most likely to actually get you a job are not your close friends and family, but they are people who, you know, you don't know that well, because they are in a world that you're not. You overlap, but so people who maybe you go to church or a mosque or a synagogue with, but you don't hang out with all the time, people who, you know, are from your home neighborhood, even if they live in another country, but if they have friends who live in Baltimore. So work the edges of your circle, because those are people who know about opportunities you might know about. The fact that you speak 4 languages is really critical. And also on online platforms like Monster and LinkedIn, sometimes you can do searches that will say, you know, looking for a bilingual in this or looking for whatever, because you have a valuable skill and you need to be able to search for people looking for that skill.
So I knew this would happen at the end of the program. Our first hour here, we are slammed with callers. Let's get another one in here and remind everybody to join us tonight at 6:30 at the Maryland State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped at 415 Park Avenue, part of the Enoch Pratt Library. It's sponsored by the Enoch Pratt Library, discussing her book, The Episodic Career. So you can join us live tonight at 6:30. If you don't get through now, come on down. But let's try to get a caller in here. Let us go to 410-319-8888. Donna, you're on the air. Hi, Donna, you there? No, Donna?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Donna, you're there. Yes.
Yes, and I definitely will be there at 6:30 tonight.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
Because, you know, this speaks hard. My experiences are with government. Government has been downsizing and been using tactics to make it difficult for not only young people to get in, but people who are over 40 to stay in.
Yes.
And I'm one of the victims, and I have a group of African-American women who were victimized by our own government system. And the fight has been going on for 6 years in courts and whatever like that. My question is, what do people, when it comes to gender discrimination, when it comes to government, how government has been, you know, the the backbone of causing a lot of this problem and being discriminating in senses of people of 40 and over not being able to get jobs and get back in that workforce. What has your book addressed that?
Oh yeah,
I'll come tonight and listen. But that's been a big issue here.
So Don, I'm going to interrupt you and let Farai jump in just because we only have a few minutes left and want to give a chance to answer.
Well,
that
Donna,
question.
Thank you so much. Yes, I deal with the issues of lawsuits and I deal with gender discrimination and age discrimination. It sounds like all of those may play a part. I mean, unfortunately, the thing that I say is that lawsuits don't always work, even if you have cause, because there's such the laws are structured to put such a high burden of proof on the plaintiffs. And so while you are if you are pursuing a legal action, which it sounds like you are, you have to try your best to get assurances of non-retaliation, meaning that you will still get a good recommendation.
Right.
Like if you've done good work, even if you're suing a place. You have to say, you know, there are non-retaliation clauses, and you can actually also sue a company for basically bad-mouthing you. But you have to make sure that at least one person from your previous job, even if it's not the boss, will vouch for you because you still need recommendations. That's the first of it. Secondly, there are a lot of centers across America that deal with employment law and women. There's I forget the name of it, but there's a women's law center that's based in New York. So I would also reach out to some of these centers that deal with women, work, and law and see if you can get some advice about that. And third is don't let this, you know, legal action become your whole life. You know, seek other employment, seek, you know, whatever makes you happy so that you don't get burnt out. You don't get burnt out.
This is such a good book. It's such a good conversation. So we can't get to all the calls calling in now. But join us tonight. Farai Chidea will be speaking 6:30 at the Maryland State Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, located at 415 Park Avenue in Baltimore. It's part of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. It's sponsored by the Enoch Pratt Library. For her book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption, you can get more information at calendar.prattlibrary.org or just show up 6:30. Get there early so make sure you have a seat. For I will be there with books to sign as well as a really interesting conversation that with me on this book and more. So please join us there tonight. For it's a really pleasure to have you back in Baltimore.
Thanks, Mark.
Really good to see
Love
you.
It.
So we have to take a short break and come back. Cindy Walsh is with us to talk about her bid to become the mayor. Don't go away, but join us tonight 6:30 at the Enoch Pratt.